This is a download from Forced Migration Online. To find out more, please go to www.forcedmigration.org.
Pleasure to introduce you to Laura Hammond, who has very kindly come all the way from London to be with us today. It's a particular pleasure for me to welcome Laura because my first teaching job was in fact providing maternity cover for Laura a few years ago, and then I had the pleasure of working with her in SOAS on the masters that she convenes in mobility, migration and development. Laura has wide array of research interests, including food security, repatriation, and different forms of migration, and has a particular geographical expertise vis-a-vis East Horn of Africa, or Horn of Africa, East Africa. And she's the author of This Place Will Become Home, which is a 2004 publication which many of you will be very familiar with. And today she's going to be speaking on transnationalism, a fourth durable solution, once she's caught her breath. And thank you very much, Laura.
No problem. Thank you. Really sorry about being late. And thank you for bearing with me and staying here. Can you hear me all right in Geneva?
Perfect.
Okay, great. It's really nice to be back here. As some of you know, I think my journey in forced migration studies started here with Nick years and years ago, 100 years ago, it seems like. But here we are, still standing. So it's nice to come back. I kind of feel like it's a bit like coming home, in fact, if as problematic as that term may be. What I wanted to do today is to borrow from a lot of the thoughts of people gathered in this room, as well as Katie and Geneva, and talk a bit about the idea of transnationalism as a fourth durable solution. But I want to locate that discussion within some recent research that I've been doing with a team of people, some of whom you'll recognize, which looks at the Somali diaspora, both the sort of Western-based Somali diaspora as well as those who are inside the country. And I'll explain a bit more why diaspora studies inside the country is relevant here as I get into this. But before I do that, I want to... What do I do?
Wheel.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Just start off with a proposition, which is, first of all, that transnationalism might be a preferred solution for some migrants. I think that some of the literature that looks at transnationalism potentially as a durable solution or as a phenomenon kind of refers to the idea that sort of transnationalism arises because there are no other options. And in the case that I'll talk about today, transnationalism is not necessarily the only option, but it's the chosen option on the part of the people that we've been working with. And so I want to ask us to think through what it might be for transnationalism to be not just an available solution, but actually one amongst many, but the most desirable. It is also, I think, part of my proposition that assistance that relates to refugees and migrants, and by which I also mean integration assistance or integration programs in countries of resettlement, are really ill-suited to these strategies. They tend to, as a lot of the literature has mentioned, and I'll talk about this in a minute, they tend to look at the fact that they tend to think about transnationalism as a sort of side product of what happens when people are resettled or when they locally integrate, rather than kind of really speaking to this kind of multi-locational situation, situatedness that migrants tend to find themselves in. And that because of that, these integration programs that exist, such as they are, not really sort of integration programs, but the kinds of integration or strategies or activities that are meant to facilitate integration really don't fully address the wide complexity of transnational lifestyles. There are a few assumptions that underline the durable solutions paradigm, and I won't go through, of course, what the durable solutions paradigm is. We're all pretty well familiar with it, but certainly one of those assumptions is that people really belong in one place. that either in that place should either be the country of origin, the country of first asylum, or a third country to which they've been resettled. And those of you who know my work on emplacement, which involved repatriation as a durable solution, will know that I kind of have problematized the idea by the means by which people create a sense of home or belonging, and try to kind of put in motion or problematize the idea that people can create meaningful connections to a new place, which in the late 1990s, early 2000s, when I was writing about it, was really aimed at trying to contribute to this debate on sedentarization and sedentarism in the sense that people necessarily were better off because they went home or they went back to their country of origin. And so it was kind of framed around that, and certainly that was relevant for the people that I was working with, who were Ethiopian refugees who'd come back to Ethiopia from 10 years of living in refugee camps in Sudan. The people that I've been working with most recently, as you'll see in this case study, I hope, are sort of emplaced, multiply emplaced in a sense. They have multiple attachments, and their livelihood strategies are very much a kind of creative manipulation of these different spaces. Certainly I'm not the first person to have written about this. Nick has written about it, Anna Lindley's written about it as well, but maybe I'll just give a slightly different perspective on that. I think as well one of the assumptions is that, or one of my assumptions has been that the kind of insistence on a singular attachment to a singular place has really been guided by logistical convenience rather than really following on migrants' priorities and preferences themselves. So it's sort of convenient when people choose to be multiply emplaced, or when they choose a particular durable solution that fits a kind of governmental or intergovernmental strategy, but I don't think that these policies are truly kind of following migrants' own thinking about what are the best options for them. So we can think and perhaps talk about this in the discussion of what it might mean to have a truly kind of migrant-centered, durable solution strategy. And then I think that we have to kind of also confront the fact that mobility is still, despite the fact that we've been talking about the problems of sedentarism and the difficulties of casting people into sort of frozen spaces, it is still true that mobility is seen as problematic. And there is a sort of celebratory rhetoric of the power of remittances as engines of development. And we just had an exam question on our migration, mobility, and development MSc course where we said, you know, discuss the issue of whether or not migrants are agents of development, which was a fantastic opportunity to kind of critique this. I discovered, quite to my surprise in writing this paper, that another one of our questions was, is transnationalism a good durable solution? So maybe this is my contribution to our exam question, and maybe I'm going to just sound like what the 25 essays I've just been reading have been saying. But hopefully I'll bring in my own bit. So just kind of to keep in mind these general assumptions about the nature of the durable solution paradigm, and be interested to hear what you think about that later on. Just to pay a little bit of an intellectual debt to some of those who are gathered here as well as elsewhere, I wanted to mention some of the work that's been done on thinking about transnational solutions or durable solutions, transnationalism as a durable solution. Certainly Nick's work on transnational households, the ways in which households split and then use different strategies, different members use different strategies, not just to support themselves as individuals, but to support themselves as a corporate whole, as a household, has been really useful to me in thinking through this. And certainly it's based on some of the work that Cindy Horse has done with Somalis, and I think Anna's work as well. So that's been useful, as well as the idea of a kind of enduring solution. So maybe we can have this discussion at the end about whether or not we're talking about durable solutions, or are we in fact talking about the idea of an enduring solution for want of a better, more permanent solution. We're talking something that is still has a kind of lasting power to it. And I've also found very useful these concepts of near and far diasporas, and I'll talk about that in a minute in terms of the structure of the study that we did. Also, Dehaz's work on the problematic terms of origin, destination, permanence, temporariness, return, migrants, all of these things I think have been really useful. And the idea that people are constantly in circulation and constantly moving, I think challenges us to think about whether or not our own responses to those sort of migratory, mobile phenomenon are actually kind of keeping up with them or not. And then finally Katie and Jeff's work on recent work in Refuge, looking at the extent to which UNHCR is taking on board the idea of a centrist approach really not being a useful model, and trying to kind of set in motion its own migration response policies has been useful, I think, as well in framing some of these ideas. So having kind of prefaced this whole thing, let me now just describe to you a little bit about this study that I've just been working on for the last year with a team of colleagues, some of whom you may recognize. Mustafa Awad is at the Somaliland Academy for Peace and Development. Ali Ibrahim Dagani is an independent consultant. Peter Hansen from the Danish Institute of International Studies. Cindy Horst from the Peace Research Institute in Oslo. Ken Menkhaus from Davidson College, and Lynette Obara, who is a statistician from the Nairobi-based Strathmore College. We all work together on this project. Many of us have worked with Somalis and on Somali issues for a very long time. Ken, probably the longest, since the early 1980s, long before state collapse and the fascination with Somali refugees. So one of the great kind of attractions of this project to me was that it was a team of people that I really wanted to work with for a very long time. And this was a study commissioned by UNDP Somalia, and if you've ever worked on Somali issues, you know that that was a little bit problematic in the sense that the UN, particularly UNDP in Somalia, has an extremely poor reputation amongst the Somali communities, partly because of its involvement in state building and its insistence on support for the transitional federal government, which was problematic throughout the research process. However, I think that it signaled, the fact that UNDP was interested in commissioning this side of the study showed that they're trying to find ways of engaging with the wider Somali community that doesn't just go down the sort of TFG support line. So I think that was both an advantage and a disadvantage of the study, and I've talked about that with UNDP in quite a lot of detail. And our main basic charge was to look at the extent to which the diaspora is involved in supporting relief development and what I call politics, writ so widely. We were sort of given a mandate to look at peace building, but I'm not sure exactly where the line is between peace building and peace fueling, and conflict fueling when you're talking about funding al-Shabaab, the insurgent movement. Is that with a view towards bringing a quick end to the conflict, or is it with an eye towards fueling the conflict? So I'd sort of refer to it more broadly as politics. So we came into this trying not to redo some of the quite good work that's been done by people like Anna Lindley and Cindy Horst, to some extent, who's looked at remittances, and others who've looked at really private remittance flows. One of the reasons for that is obviously it has been done quite a lot, but as well, we were concerned that from a UNDP perspective, the emphasis should be on that which can produce the largest development impact, notwithstanding the literature and those who argue that clearly remittances do have a developmental impact. We thought that we would look specifically at collective remittances in this case, which is something really hasn't been looked at quite so much before. So we did some research both inside and outside Somalia, and we used six sort of diaspora hubs, Dubai, London, Minneapolis, Oslo, Toronto, and Nairobi, which then was where Nick's idea of the neo-diaspora comes in quite well, because we were surprised to find when we got to Nairobi to start this project that actually in most diaspora research, Nairobi's always left out. It's seen as just a neighborhood of Mogadishu, in fact, that doesn't involve the diaspora, which is really quite strange because it's a major staging area for people who are coming from the further abroad diaspora. It's a central organizing point for the business community and the political community, and there's just quite a lot going on there that is different from what's going on inside the country, yet also quite different from what's going on in the further abroad diaspora. We also did research inside Somaliland, and we moved throughout the entire area of Somaliland, Puntland, in the three major cities of Garowe, Bosaso, and North Galkayo, and then south-central Somalia in Adado, Beledweyne, Johar, Merka, Mogadishu, and South Galkayo. At the time, three of those towns were controlled by the transitional federal government, and three were under control of al-Shabaab, which was really useful, lucky for us, in a sense, to be able to gather this information. And we did it really I shouldn't even claim credit for having done it, in fact, because what we did was work through a local management institute called CMAD, which had people already located in these six sites in South Central, so they didn't need to move around and they didn't need to put themselves at unnecessary risk. That was one of the concerns that I had about doing this research, that we not put researchers at risk. And so we got quite a lot of information, although some of the information that we had originally hoped to be able to get was not possible, given the insecurity and the concerns on the part of those who are working in, particularly in South Central, about not having too high a profile that they might come under suspicion or attack by any party to the conflict, really. And inside the country, we did both quantitative and qualitative data analysis and collection. We carried out a survey with local NGOs, social service providers, by which I define that social service providers can be anything from a government-run hospital, there's one, to a for-profit school, because they tend not to actually turn a profit at this point. So they're sort of different from non-governmental organizations in that they potentially could be profit-making, but at the moment really aren't. And then we also looked at private investors, and private investors clearly as engines of development themselves, whether you're talking about major money transfer companies or telecommunications companies, which are the sort of big and very visible businesses, or even just people who own restaurants, people who run businesses that employ a dozen, two dozen, three dozen people, already are engines of development because they're creating really badly needed jobs, particularly for young people in Somalia. So we did these surveys and we also followed them up with focus group interviews. And in Somaliland and Puntland, we had the benefit of having Peter Hansen on the ground, who had done, as many of you know, has done a lot of work in Somaliland, and could go and talk to some of the people that he'd been working with over the 10-year period and kind of see how their engagement has changed over time. Many of them are themselves returnees from the diaspora. That was the kind of work inside the country, Somali, if you consider Somaliland to be part of the country. And then in the diaspora hubs, we mostly did qualitative research because we didn't have the staff or the time or the budget to do much more than that. But I think what we did was trade basically on our existing knowledge of the networks. And so I managed the UK-based research with the Somali communities. Ken Menkaus did the Toronto and Minneapolis ones. Cindy worked in Oslo. And Peter worked in Dubai and a bit in Nairobi as well. So in that way, we tried as much as possible to get as deep information in as short a period of time as possible. And we were looking particularly at the kinds of remittances that people send. Am I going to get to that? I'll get to that in a minute. Trying to sort of map out different types of transnational linkages between people outside Somalia and outside the Horn of Africa and inside, and to get a sense of the kinds of factors that influence people's ability to engage in collective remittance sending. So just to give a sense of where Somalis of course are pretty much everywhere, but these are some of the major hubs. Someone told me recently about Somali community in Alaska. My father told me about the Somali community in Alaska that he'd been reading about. I mean, literally they're everywhere. But some of the major hubs, obviously, Minneapolis, Toronto, Ottawa, Los Angeles, Atlanta, Washington, D.C., in North America. Obviously, the UK has the largest, London is the largest Somali population in Europe, but as well there are large populations in Denmark, Oslo, and Norway, Italy, of course, Netherlands, I mean, every country. And just to make the point as well, I should have put in more of the Asia and Australia connections because there are quite sizable ones. It's a very large student population in Malaysia. There's a very large population in South Africa as well. And this is my version of Nick's blob graphic that you've probably seen often, with the different people located in different ways and the ways that they relate to each other. And quite importantly, just to say that they don't all just relate back to the Horn of Africa, they also relate transnationally between different countries. Right? So in the fundraising they do sometimes goes back to the Horn, but it may also circulate for a variety of activities that don't actually go back to the Horn, but in fact move between Europe and North America, for instance, or other places. Don't worry about the detail of this, but I just wanted, this is our kind of conceptual framework that we were asked to come up with. But one of the important kind of elements of it are that we kind of mapped different layers of the diaspora. So we had this is outside in the diaspora, different kinds of channels by which people engage collectively in remittance sending. And by remittance sending, we're not just talking about money, we're talking as well about technical support, people giving their time and their skills for a variety of activities. So we looked at individuals, families, clan, what we call clan or hometown associations. There's a lot of literature, obviously, on hometown associations. And we found in the Somali context it was useful to adapt that slightly to talk about clan-based associations so that people are sending not necessarily to a specific locality but to a specific clan area. And that happens quite a lot, although there are some interesting efforts to try to transcend that and to engage in a broader way as well. There are lots of local NGOs, which I'll talk about in a few minutes. And there are also quite a few professional associations and what we might call transnational associations. So professional associations might be an association of Somali midwives, so it's an association of teachers, veterinary practitioners, agricultural economists, all of these different kinds of professional associations, some of which existed prior to the collapse of the state in 1991, and some of which have constituted themselves in the meantime as people have left the country. They've sort of found each other, often based on people who were teaching in the university before they left, people who were in the same sort of batch of professional trainees within the country at the time. And they engage in very in interesting ways, sometimes having to do with money, sometimes having to do more with the transfer of technical skills. We looked at, and this is kind of, I'll spend a bit of time just talking about this layer and the local layer, the local actor layer, in which case we looked at local NGOs, social service providers, and private investors, which is why I just highlighted these. But if you want to go through our 100-page report, you can read about the rest of the variables as well. And those of you who may have heard something about Somali diaspora will know that the main means of transfer of funds in any way from the diaspora to local areas is through almost exclusively Somali-run network called the Hawalad system, which is involves multinational corporations now, that's what they are, set up by Somalis that basically function, operate in every country where Somalis are, bring transfer money at a very low rate and fully electronically to the destination town, no matter how small, and the recipient can collect the money within a matter of sometimes minutes. And so this system is different than other diaspora connections in which Western Union plays a role or other kind of non, sort of indigenized, for want of a better word, transfer mechanisms are in place. So we looked a bit at that and at some of the constraints surrounding the Hawalad system. And then we looked at kind of what's the output. And I'm not going to speak about that so much now because it's not really related to my particular theme about transnationalism as a fourth durable solution, but if you're interested in some of those findings, I can go back to them later on. Just a few kind of selected findings that I think are worth mentioning here. It is estimated that the total flow of remittances to Somalia is anywhere from $1.3 to $2 billion a year. And it's quite difficult to get any more exact than that. That's pretty much based on the self-reporting of the Hawalad companies in terms of the kinds of traffic that they manage. And we know that there are lots and lots of reasons, of course, for under-reporting these figures and misreporting them. But we have, you know, that I think that this is a pretty safe, even if a very broad range of $1.3 to $2 billion. And based on the work that we did in terms of talking to senders, talking to transfer operators, and to some extent to receivers, a sort of rough estimate of the amount of remittances sent for collective purposes, for specifically development or relief-related purposes, is about $130 to $200 million, which is still very huge, actually. All things told, when you consider that international assistance to all of Somalia is not only about, probably about twice as much, the total is about twice as much of that. A lot of that gets taken up by overheads and security costs and other things that these expenses are not subject to. So the actual impact might almost be similar to what the impact of this is. And we know that remittances are attractive to international organizations, particularly because they do things that international aid can't do. They speak, they reach exactly to where they're targeted. They're quite well monitored. They're quite, it's possible to see what they're spent on. They tend to have a more visible, efficient, clearly identifiable impact than a lot of the international assistance. So there's an interest in trying to figure out, I think from the UN's perspective, there was an interest in trying to figure out how one could maximize the impact of these flows without actually disrupting them. And that's quite an important caveat. In the work we did, both in the diaspora as well as inside the country, clearly we found that there is a huge amount of not just financial flows that are going on between the diaspora and people inside the country, but in fact, all kinds of these technical transfers. There are lots and lots of people serving as on boards of trustees, as investors, shareholders. Somalis tend to start businesses through a kind of shareholding practice where you have many, many investors who all have a piece of whatever it is they're investing in. And they draw on both wealthy people and inside the country as well as in the diaspora. So it's usually a kind of hybrid investment. Political lobbyists, we saw a lot of activity in the recent Somaliland elections in 2010 of lobbying that went on, particularly within the UK, which has a very large Somaliland population, not only in trying to make sure that their own party won, and it's not, I don't think it's an accident that the party with the strongest diaspora support, Rumia, actually won the presidential election, but as well just trying to make sure that the platform issues, the political issues that people in the diaspora thought were important actually made it onto the political stage and made it into the debates. We're also, they're also really active in that. The kinds of social service activities that we found going on tended to circulate around health, education, water, some orphanages that were run by diaspora funds. We found some new kinds of fundraising that goes on inside the country where local people who have got an idea of something they want to get started or they have a social service provider or a local NGO that's already involved in providing services will invite people who are home visiting on vacation to come and hear what's going on and have be hosted for an evening, and then of course they start rattling their cans and asking for donations, which is a relatively new thing to start kind of targeting people as they come back for family visits. I sort of said basically what I wanted to say about private investors being engines of development and social service providers. We found very useful in this study the idea of a part-time diaspora, and it's something that I've been thinking about a lot. And I think it would be interesting to know whether in the work that other people here do, there is such a thing as a part-time diaspora with regard to other groups. But certainly, we had a hard time defining who was a member of the diaspora, who was a returnee, who was a local resident in the work that we did inside Somaliland, Puntland. So we ended up defining diaspora members as people who spend more than 3 months a year outside of the country. Because we thought that if you spend more than 3 months outside, you're not just going for a visit, you're actually probably engaging in some kind of economic activity as well. And that seemed to be pretty well held up by the people that we interviewed. So if you use that as a definition, we found that at least half of all of the three cabinets in Somaliland, Puntland, and the transitional federal government, each of those cabinets have at least 50% diaspora membership, if you like, and which has really had an interesting impact in terms of bringing in different kinds of ideas to the political discourse that goes on, but it's also created quite a lot of tensions between those who have remained behind and those who are diaspora returnees. And there have been some recent articles in the press about the fact that the transitional federal government is relying too much on diaspora returnees, that they are being brainwashed by their Western friends, a whole range of kinds of things. So this is a really quite important issue that's going on within the Somali community itself, that it needs to, the diaspora needs to try to create some more linkages with local people inside the country if they're going to have legitimacy to be able to operate. Many of them have mixed family strategies, similar to those described by Nick in his work. where you have people who are deliberately sent by families outside the country to secure a place somewhere, to secure permanent residence, to secure employment, to try to open up educational opportunities. The idea is that they'll eventually bring more family members out to help relieve the burden on themselves, to support the family. But I think most families don't have the idea that the entire family will leave the country. They have this idea that some people should remain inside, either to do community service, to be there for the clan, kinds of negotiations, to manage the family assets as such as they are that remain inside the country. And so it's not necessarily a strategy for everyone to leave, which I think defies some of the common kind of conventional wisdom about how Somali decision making is taking place. We also found that a lot of the business community are using mobility as a risk management strategy. So this idea of Nairobi as a commercial and political hub outside of Mogadishu has been really quite important in the sense that people have not completely abandoned all of their activities inside the capital, but that for the most part they've moved their families out to somewhere safer like Nairobi, and they then come in and out periodically. And there's a recent estimate that about 12,000 people a month fly in and out of Mogadishu. The UK Home Office is quite interested in this because they think it might mean that it's safe to send everyone back. Whereas I'm trying to develop an argument to say to them, actually no, what it suggests is that it's so risky that people can only afford to be there for a short period of time. They come in quickly, do their business, take those risks for themselves, usually as individuals, as head of household, and then they leave to go back to their families where they're safer. And very few of them are actually willing to move with the whole family back to the capital. So this is my diagram of a revolving door, which has nothing to do with Somali. I found it on Google's revolving door. But it helps to show the idea that people are always coming and going. And when I've talked to Somalis about this idea that it somehow may make the Somali diaspora somewhat different than others, I think there's some general broad agreement that that is the case, that there is a sense of people coming and going. And we can talk about some of the policy problematics of that as well later on, if you like. Also, I find useful this idea, which was suggested to me. We had a workshop in Nairobi a couple weeks ago where we presented the report that we'd just done to a group of about 100 Somalis from both inside Somalia as well as from the diaspora. And one woman referred to herself as the post-diaspora. She had returned from Canada, and she's now living in Galgadud in south-central Somalia. She was referring to herself as a post-diaspora, not because she had returned. She wasn't a returnee. She was planning, in fact, on going back to North America the next week. But in some almost a sort of post-modern sense, in the sense that she was now inhabiting this kind of circular space of moving in and out. And she was not, she didn't fully think of herself, of course, as being a diaspora member, but she also wasn't fully inside. She was kind of in this interstitial space, or this mobile space of inhabiting multiple places at once. But I think this is relevant to refer to a few kinds of phenomena that we found within our quantitative analysis, where we found a very high number of social service providers, staff of these institutions, who were returnees, or we might call them post-diaspora. In South Central Somalia, a very high rate, 68.2% of social service provider staff had lived outside the country at some point in the last 10 years, I think it was, that we asked. Puntland and Somaliland had much lower rates, which is an interesting finding. One might think that with the heightened insecurity in the south that people would be more reluctant to go. I don't think that this means that there are more people returning to the insecurity of South Central Somalia. What it means probably is that those who are returning to work in social service sector rather than to work in the private sector or in other areas, and so they're identified as such. We also, again, private investor returnees were also very high in South Central. When you talk to the sort of medium to large scale business owners, almost all of them, 88.9% of them, were returnees from somewhere, which is much, much higher than in Puntland or even Somaliland. There were also a very high rate of these kind of board members or trustees for local NGOs. In South Central, 84%, much lower percents in Puntland and Somaliland. Again, probably because in Somaliland there's a much more diversified economy, and so people are doing a whole range of things, and there are more professionals who are not necessarily returnees who are also serving in these positions. So maybe why the differences are so stark, but I thought interesting to point out that there are quite major differences within the three major zones of what we call Somalia. We also looked a bit at youth involvement, and there's a kind of the conventional wisdom, which it says that second generation members of diasporas don't really engage as much, and there's a concern on the part of not only international aid providers, but amongst diasporas themselves, that when children grow up, they will forsake their relatives who live behind. And that may be true to some extent. Surely if a person who's born outside of Somalia grows up never having met their grandmother or their aunt or uncle, when they become an adult, they tend not to have that same imperative, same feeling of obligation to provide assistance, and so they may not engage as much in that kind of individualized remittance provision. But we found some really interesting and I think quite important examples of youth who are engaged in collective remittances instead, who have been raised outside of Somalia for most of their lives, but still identify themselves very much as Somali, and their way of finding other Somalis like them and of being part of a diaspora community has involved relating back to the country of origin. So they do this in a variety of ways. Some of them, when they get their first jobs, give their paychecks to their fathers, who then send it off to their aunties. Sure, that happens. But at the same time, there's also a range of activities of youth who are organizing to provide assistance to the refugees in Dadaab refugee camp. There is a UK Somali Students, is quite a large organization based in the UK that's trying to raise scholarship funds for 10 universities throughout Somalia, Somaliland, Puntland, and South Central. They want to get enough money for 200 scholarships in their first year, which is in September. They say that they're halfway to their target goal already, and that's quite significant. And they have a really interesting idea about how they want to give back. They've kind of thought it out pretty well, that they want to have 200 scholarships. They want each of these 10 universities to contribute themselves 2 scholarships each, so there's a bit of cost sharing. They want everyone who receives a scholarship to be committed to teaching 5 more people to learn to read and write. So, you know, they clearly thought about what they're doing. They're not just giving $5 and hope, or £5 and hoping that it all turns into something positive, or they're also not just thinking that that's for their own benefit as a feeling somehow that they've paid at the door or something. There's also an interesting plan underway, which is called Operation Restore Hope 2012. You may recall that immediately following the collapse of the Somali state, there was a US, UN-led humanitarian operation referred to as Operation Restore Hope, which was basically the start of the sort of military humanitarian intervention, aimed primarily in the first instance at opening up spaces of sort of humanitarian access to provide famine relief. And then it sort of metamorphosized into a kind of state-building, peace-building operation that's more similar to what you see now. So the students have decided to recapture this name and to make it into something very different from what it originally was. They want to bring back 1,000 students next August to get engaged for weeks or months in various kinds of development activities, and they've got almost 400 people who've already signed up to that initiative. And I think it's, you know, their idea is that when you step off the plane in August 2012 with 1,000 students who have grown up outside the country, it sends quite an important message in several different ways. One, to the people who've remained inside Somalia, who feel that they've been abandoned, perhaps, by young people. And second, internationally, it sends another message, because if you look at the press today, and if you Google Somali youth, all you'll come up with is stories about youth being recruited into the Al-Shabaab movement and becoming suicide bombers and joining the insurgency. And there is, for every one person who does that, there are probably 100 others who are trying to engage in more positive ways. So they want to try to kind of alter that image. So I think quite important to look at what the youth are doing and think about what that suggests about our assumptions about youth in the diaspora. To say something about the UK diaspora, it's again very hard to say how many there are living in the UK, anywhere from 95,000 to 250,000. Most Somalis will say 250,000, of course. The last official estimate was about 82,000. So hopefully in the next round of the census we'll get a better idea of how many. But regardless of the number, the significance of the UK-based Somali community is that it's older than most Somali communities in Europe and North America. Because of the long ties between the UK and Somaliland in particular, many people have come long before the political crisis in Somalia, came as merchant marines members first, then came as students, have lived here for a very long time, which means that they tend to be better established and they tend to be in a better position to be actually able to relate to their country of origin. And so there's a lot of kind of quite vital engagement that one may not find. For instance, I've worked in Lewiston, Maine in the US, and it's very hard. There is some support going on, but people who've just arrived are so busy trying to find their feet, trying to secure their housing, find employment, learn English, make sure that their children get into the schools, that they're not able to engage as quite as much. So I think that there's a really important message which comes out of this, and I'll talk about this in a minute, about integration and the value of integration for actually strengthening these transnational bonds. If you go to the Charities Commission and you type in Somali, you'll get 236 different charities registered, which of course not all of them are active, but there are many who are active, and there are many more than 236 for sure that are not registered at all and just operate on an ad hoc basis. Some organizations spring up in response to a particular crisis, so the current drought that's going on in much of South Central Somalia, when there have been floods in Somaliland, there have been sort of pop-up NGOs, if you like, to try to get money to rebuild bridges or roads or whatever it is. So there's sort of situational type NGOs as well as kind of longer lasting ones. I want to say something about this challenges to effective support, despite the fact that in the UK you have quite a well-established Somali communities probably, because they are kind of sometimes separate, the Somaliland community is sometimes very separate from those from the south, yet in some moments they'll join together to kind of put aside their differences and galvanize for a common cause. What the people that we spoke to who were living in the diaspora said that one of the main obstacles to being able to engage more broadly was that they had experienced lots of difficulties with integration, with getting their immigration status settled, whether they were asylum seekers or being reunified with their families or whatever it is. It can take many years to be able to actually go through the whole application and appeal process and final kind of settlement of status. And in the meantime, most people don't work, most people put aside their own personal educational goals or career goals, and it's very difficult then to relate to sending collective remittances. We found, of course, that people do manage, even under the most trying conditions, to send individualized remittances anyway, through a whole range of sort of money-saving strategies. The obligation to provide for your family it takes priority over much of your own feeling of needing to be comfortable. So that tends to go on. But the kind of collective remittances that we've been looking at tend to be really thwarted by a failure to promote integration or to facilitate integration. The current climate in which the climate in which we carried out this research, so we started it last summer and we just finished it, was particularly trying because of the intense suspicions around the extent to which members of the Somali community are involved in fueling the conflict, whether through fundraising or through mobilizing people, through recruitment. That is one aspect of a sort of climate of distrust that people are operating in that makes it very difficult. People said that they found it hard to send large amounts of money because they were afraid that they would be suspected of funding the wrong source. When we did the North America interviews, we did it 1 week after 14 people were indicted for terrorism charges. And their response to the charges were to say, we're not funding al-Shabaab, we're funding relief and development activities. And then poor Ken Menkaus came along saying, tell me about funding your relief and development activities. And you can understand that people tended to be quite kind of careful about what they said. But we had the benefit of being able to work with people in the community who could really, trusted our kind of questions and knew that we weren't working for the CIA or whatever other security force there may be. But still, that made it just influenced a lot of the information we were able to get, and I think it influences the ability of the diaspora to really effectively act as a sort of safety net for people living inside the country. Obviously, there's an insecure environment for both foreigners working inside Somalia as well as Somali intellectuals and activists. There have been lots of targets of human rights workers, teachers, medical students, aid workers inside the country, and that makes people quite uneasy about actually providing support. Many of the people we talked to in South Central Somalia said that they were worried about telling us how much money they received from abroad because in an Al-Shabaab area, the fact that you receive money from the Western diaspora suggests that you have other ties as well, and you could be targeted either for being robbed to get the money back or just for being somehow not fully supportive of Al-Shabaab's ideological orientation. So very difficult to get that kind of information. And I think it's not just about the kind of information we get, but I think that it thwarts the amount of support that's actually sent, as people are afraid of people don't want to put their own relatives at risk, so they tend not to send as much as they might otherwise. And clearly this level of distrust of international organizations has led to a whole kind of breakdown, so that I think that a lot of the kind of effective collaboration that could go on between the diaspora and the UN in particular hasn't happened, and there's a real need to address that, the absence of trust. In thinking about this idea of transnationalism now as a fourth durable solution, I'm sorry, I've kind of digressed a little bit.
I'm doing it with the mouse.
Oh, sorry. Have I not?
You've got to go back on
Have I been going
there? No, I have to sync now.
No, I'm here. Sorry. Yeah, here. That's where I am. Sorry.
This one.
What's happening to that one?
Because you need to go back and make them matching.
Oh, I see. Sorry. Didn't realize there were two on two things. Okay, fine. Thanks, Oliver. Okay, challenges to effective support. I'm sorry, I've already done that one. Now we have to do the next one. There we go. Okay, so is integration the goal? This is my question. I've said that integration, that a lack of integration can certainly thwart people's ability to engage transnationally. And the importance of transnationalism isn't just about the funds that are sent, but it's about actually the sort of integrity of this multiply situated families. I think that that integration is not actually the ultimate endpoint for most of the Somalis that we interviewed in this study. Many people are engaged for a variety of reasons in the country of origin. Young Somalis, as I've just mentioned, are interested in engaging, or their relation to the country of origin has a lot to do with their own feeling of themselves as Somalis, as Muslims, as sort of British, you know, sort of British Somali. There's somewhat separate identity that goes outside the sense of being a young Somali, that separates a diasporan young Somali from someone inside the country. But I think that many people their ultimate objective is to establish a kind of a foothold in the country that they've moved to, and then return in a part-time basis to Somalia, Somaliland, Puntland, to have this kind of multiple migratory mobile strategy that isn't about investing putting all of your eggs in one basket, trying to be in one place or another. And they want, people that we spoke to about their kind of overall objectives were really saying, we're in the UK, for instance, until we get our permanent residence and our ability to travel, and then we will move to, not necessarily back to Somalia, maybe to Dubai to set up a business, maybe to North America to do something else. But the idea was to develop the ability to move transnationally as much as possible, and that all of that had something to do with, as well, supporting families who, some of whom were outside and some of whom were inside the international territory of Somalia. There are some problems with that, of course, because the assumption, the sort of sedentarist-influenced assumption that integration is about engaging with the country that one's moved to rather than the country that one comes from, is a kind of overriding justification for how integration should take place. And if you look at the kind of political discourse in any country where not just Somalis, but diaspora populations are settled, there is an interest in trying to break down the barriers, obviously, between those who sort of original dwellers and those who come from migrant backgrounds. But this idea of this relationship between integration and origin country engagement is really not well understood. And so there's this idea that migrants should, when they come to a sort of a so-called adopted country — I've been told by Somalis to use the word diaspora country only and not talk about adopted or resettled or receiving or destination or host, any of those countries — that we should just talk about diaspora countries, which is fine. So there's an assumption that that someone coming to a diaspora country should, that all of their economic activity and all of their contribution should be oriented towards that new home, in a sense. And I think that there's a problematic of trying to make public the idea that actually people are here for a bit, may contribute to the overall economy, but may also contribute to another economy or several other economies in meaningful ways. I think there may be some public opinion problems with that as a message, which makes it difficult in a way to frame conclusions out of this research, because I don't want to draw attention to a kind of strategy that people are involved in that may be ultimately unpopular. I think it's also problematic to think that actually integration may not be the end goal. There's lots of policy debates about to what extent are we succeeding at integration. When, if integration is not the goal of migrants, then the question then is, why should we try to make integration easier for people? And again, I think this partly has to do with the idea that that the more integrated people are, the more in fact they also are able to engage with the country of origin. That kind of relationship is really not well understood. And I think then that we have to come to a point where we say, well, integration is quite important, not necessarily in and of itself, but it's as a means for success, for the maintenance of successful transnational livelihoods. And there is a way of framing this debate in such a way as to kind of take the lead from the migrants themselves, who are choosing this highly mobile, kind of multiply situated lifestyle. In order for that kind of thing to work, there needs to be really meaningful integration, not just perhaps in one place, but maybe in multiple places for that sort of transnational household, if you like. Finally, I think I'm at the end here, yes, my last slide. Wanted to think about what kinds of strategies could be used to facilitate transnational livelihoods. And this is, of course, the outcome of what UNDP was interested in this study, but I think a lot of some of the recommendations that we came up with kind of transcend what UNDP is interested in. And we have the uncomfortable finding, in a way, that some of the results of this study actually relate more to maybe the Home Office in a UK context, maybe the Ministry of Communities, or whatever it's called now, here in the UK. We need to kind of deliver our message in a multiple of different kinds of directions in order to really make an impact. But clearly there's a need to support diaspora organizations. Many of them are not registered or not formally constituted, partly because they don't really know how to be formally constituted. And there are benefits to being formally recognized in the sense of getting tax relief, being able to attract more donations, being able to qualify for matching funds and other kinds of support that people really are not really aware of. And so there are clearly benefits to that. There's a whole set of policy recommendations that relate to the promotion of fast asylum claim settlement, the regularization of housing, of employment and education rights, all of those kinds of things that are clearly not a sort of development or kind of Somalia-centric domain, but really belong here in a country like this, in a sort of diaspora receiving country. Clearly there needs to be a lot more public awareness about the positive aspects of a diaspora engagement, because this issue of integration being a hard sell, the fact that people are not necessarily interested in integration, yet integration is necessary for them to have transnational livelihoods, involves a whole kind of public awareness about the nature of mobile and transnational livelihoods that hasn't really taken place yet. And then finally, to think about inside the country of origin, how these engagements might be enhanced. There's a whole range of activities that we've gone into in a lot more detail in our report, looking at the possibilities of matching funds and investment incentives for investment and other kinds of support that could help to create a kind of fertile receiving ground for the kinds of collective remittances that people are already engaged in. And the trick in that case, and this is very much the subject of the workshop that we had in Nairobi a couple weeks ago, was how to facilitate that kind of a process without actually disrupting the sense of Somali ownership and leadership that's already occurring in the kind of diaspora support that's being provided. So that's where our current challenge on that lands. I'm going to leave it here and happy to answer any questions.
If you've enjoyed this download, you might like to listen to other podcasts of Forced Migration Online. www.forcedmigration.org/podcasts